But the important thing here is that there's no indication that Abraham knows that this is the case before he does it. So he's basically, for three strangers, he brings them in, basically tells them here, sit under the tree, a nice restful area, and he washes their feet, and then he gives them food. Back at this time, that's actually a pretty big deal. I kind of looked up some of the numbers on it, and obviously there's some debate over some of this stuff, but generally speaking, what I was able to find was the price of a calf that he offered here was between 20 and 25 denarii. So Abraham essentially gave up 3 to 4 weeks' worth of wages for the average working man to three strangers. Now, Abraham was a very wealthy man. He had herds to himself, so this is a little bit different. But if you can just imagine the, from our, like if we were to do something of a similar nature, it's almost like us giving up nearly a month's worth of our wages, of our work, giving it to three strangers to eat for one meal. Yeah, that's very hospitable.
To show off for you guys here, that's how wealthy I am. But this is a whole different motivation here. I mean, this is the calf that could, you know, later on be used for milk and all kinds of things. Abraham wasn't just giving up the calf. He was giving up everything that calf represented for the rest of its life. That's significant hospitality.
Yeah, it is very significant. Notice at... where is that? Verse 8, the very end of verse 8, it says that he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. He's essentially a waiter. He is a servant. How many servants did Abraham have? I don't know the exact count, but he took I think it was a 100 or 200, I forgot how many, his servants, his household together to go into battle. Abraham was a wealthy man, and yet he essentially has humbled himself to the point where he is actually serving these three strangers himself. Does this seem extreme to you? It's what you expect from a man of God. That's a good point. It's a very good point.
Three people.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. It's hard to. I think it's hard to say for sure. We do know for sure he knows later. If you keep on reading in the story, he does understand later the significance of the three men. But exactly at what point in there, I don't know. Now he was at the very least he was treating them with extreme respect. Now, oh yes.
Say, I mean, it wouldn't be all that bad to lean towards just the idea that he's speaking to the Lord of some sort, because if you look up until that point from Genesis 12 all the way through, him having a conversation with God and having a covenant and getting instruction happened a lot. In other words, we got to account for it. So, not sure 100%, you know, exactly, but it not necessarily would have been a shock either. So maybe he was just being prepared for another conversation.
Yeah, just being prepared, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because he's definitely had many of them over the last, of course, the last several chapters in our book, you know. But anyways, that's just a
follow-up. Yeah, yeah, the last several chapters, true. Of course, in those last several chapters, that's a span of like 10 years. Yes, excellent point. In fact, that's exactly where I wanted to go. Acts chapter 4. I wanted to go here immediately because this kind of shows, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, what Abraham does for those three men was exceptional, extremely good hospitality. But, just like Ed mentioned, it's what you expect out of a man of God like that. Well, what do we have here in Acts 4? Acts 4 and verse 32. This is right after they had just been gone through some persecution, their first bit of persecution. In 32 it says, "And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul. Not one of them claimed there was anything belonging to him was his own, but that all things were common property to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all. And there was not a needy person among them, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as any had need." Now this is most likely more significant than just 20 to 25 denarii. I mean, usually a plot of land or a house goes for significantly more than that, doesn't it? The generosity of the Christians here at this time is, it really is something to be looked up to. And it's something that we need to be willing to do ourselves if the need arises. They did not perceive their own belongings as, I guess they were not selfish with their own belongings, but rather they accepted the fact that they should be giving them to people who need it. Now, why are these people in need? What is the reason why there's so many needy here at this particular point in time? Yes. Yeah, exactly. Most of these people were here from the Pentecost, who at that point were there mostly there because they were also there from the Passover. So they were practically here for several months. I don't know about you, but if I take several months off of work and just spend it on a vacation, that's going to be pretty hard, isn't it? Now, why is this important? Why is it important for the Christians at this time to look at their property as not as theirs, but to give it up to others in need? One heart, one soul. Yes.
They would connect to one. They don't know who were the recipients of what maybe the proceeds they made for the property they sold, because they laid it at the apostles' feet and they distributed it.
That's a good point. They didn't give it to their particular, like a friend that they knew they needed. They just gave it to the apostles, and the apostles did.
They just gave.
Right.
But that's stricken from what the earlier statement about them being one heart and one soul.
Yeah. Good point. Yes.
Well, their priorities changed. Their goal of life changed. Their whole spiritual world changed. And when that happened, you know, the things of this earth, you know, became secondary and to the goal of preaching the word and teaching others about this good news.
Yeah, so you're saying they had goals in life for the earlier where they accumulated the property, the goals then changed and they got rid of it. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes?
And the need was great. And there was no one else to fill the need.
Yeah, no one else to do it. Yeah.
It's not like the Roman government was going to support those, you know, citizens who were now living there.
Yeah.
It was fell upon them.
Yeah, it's true. They didn't exactly offer food stamps back then. I'm sorry? Yeah, there were no stimulus checks either. Nope, definitely not. I want to look back to something that Jesus said in Matthew 16. This is a fairly common passage. I'm sure we all know this fairly well. But I think this is a critical point here in this particular conversation. Matthew 16, verse 24 says, "Then Jesus says to his disciples, 'If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father and with his angels, and will repay every man according to his deeds.'" Notice Jesus does not say, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny something about himself. He must deny, you have to give up going to football games on Sundays. You're gonna have to give up doing what you want to do at certain times. That's not what he says. He says you must deny himself. That is a total denial of ourselves. Everything about us comes second to the service to Jesus. I'm sorry? It's much easier said than done. Absolutely. It is very hard to do. In fact, this is probably the most difficult of everything here, because honestly, if this part was easy, everything else comes second nature. I mean, but this is really the kind of where it all boils down to how we live our lives and what we do. And this is, we are giving ourselves completely over to God. There is nothing that we have that is not worth giving up for him. And that includes not just for our, to save our own souls, but our brother or our sister. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Whether it's convenient or not, to to even just to get to know somebody a little bit better who's of the brethren. You know, just to make an additional effort to, like, it's something you have to go out and do. If there's a need there, you're meeting a need. You know what I mean? Being hospitable is about more than just meeting a need. It's about, you know, having preference for the association with your brothers and sisters. It's about, you know, finding ways to connect with one another to be a stronger family. And so, you know, yes, it's extremely difficult to deny yourself, especially now because we have so much stuff to deny. But when it comes to being hospitable, it's an active thing that we all have to actively work to do. I have to find ways to be hospitable. I can't just wait for an opportunity to be hospitable. I've got to go get it. And I think that's even more difficult than, you know, if somebody comes up there and says, there's a need, everybody's quick to, you know, when you go into your group meetings and there's a need, okay, let's do it, let's address it. Or, you know, the text goes out, there's a need, we fulfill the need, but that's not what hospitality is. Hospitality is literally going out and finding opportunities to connect with each other and to give of yourself to one another in a proactive way, not in a response to something. So it's even more difficult than fulfilling needs. You have to go out and actively be an extrovert.
Yeah, I like the way you said that. It takes work. I mean, it being hospitable takes work. There's no getting around that. And yeah, in today's society, it's easy to be lazy. It's easy just to go home, shut our doors, sit on the couch, relax, do nothing. But is that what God wants us to do?
Yeah, that's part of denying.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, we have to give up our own, whatever our pleasures are, whatever we want to do comes secondary to what is needed. And again, it's not, there is a benefit to the technology we have today is it is so easy to actually help people. But at the same time, it's more difficult to be connected with them. Because, yeah, it's easy to, you know, here, let me just, you know, shoot you a little bit of cash and, you know, let that be it. What? Yeah, just Venmo or PayPal, you know, whatever. It's easy to do those simple little things and send a little bit of money, but does that actually, is that offering immediate help to our brother? I mean, if there's a, you know, someone who needs a place to stay for a couple of days, well, you could shoot them a couple hundred bucks here, get a hotel for a couple of days. I mean, and you can say, well, you know, I don't want the inconvenience of having him take up my spare room or my couch if I don't have a spare room. Yeah, there you go. A check. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we are not here just to check a box. My checklist, boom, I got my hospitality deed done for the day. We're good to go. Next. That is not what this is about. We are here to help each other get to heaven. And the personal touch, being together, spending time together is extremely important. For building the relationships we need to make ourselves really, it strengthens both ourselves and the person that we're with. We need to be able to know if our brother or sister is having a problem with something. You know, they need help in this particular area. Well, if we've disconnected ourselves off from everybody practically, you know, we show up here when the assembly goes, and all right, that's it. Now back to going and, you know, being an introvert. We aren't really putting ourselves in a position or where we know what our brother or sister needs, and we can actually go and really help them. I mean, giving people a super easy example is that there's quite a few situations that come up in our lives where we're. It's difficult for us to really, you know, make ourselves a meal. But it's so easy. It really is so easy for brethren to get together, to make set up a meal plan and to help out brother or sister for a week or two. It's You know, there's several things that are so easy to do. Yes. Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent point, because we are, again, we are here to bring as many people to heaven as we can, and offering hospitality to someone that is not even in the church is going to give them a, it's certainly going to make them think. It's going to make them consider, well, maybe there is something to Jesus. Yes.
They are the minority, you know. And it even says in Romans, I was just looking earlier today, Romans 5, about the peace that we have through God in Romans 5. But then he also says in verse 3, not only that, but we rejoice in our suffering, knowing that our suffering produces endurance. The deal is they had suffering in common. They had a need in common. Some of them had land and property in their head financially, but they all had a need in common, which is we need to get out of this world and we need to be joined together. And that's something that we work towards having with one another, but I think that's something that's, it's weird to say that they suffered a lot more, therefore it bonded them together. And I've often said, you know, are we too comfortable? And when I teach first century Christianity leading up to 600 AD, when Christianity is now the state religion, was Christianity really more true then versus the first century? And when I talk to the students about that after they hear the whole story, they all agree that living in the first century would have been more true, easier to be a true Christian. Does that make sense? Even though your life might be shortened, you might have a lot of suffering, but you truly got the idea of what a true Christian is supposed to be about and how togetherness really works in the meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing about persecution is it really does sort out the true Christians from the chaff. And it really does help in that regard. But it's we are so spoiled. It's not hard to go to other and look around at other places on this earth and see the what other Christians have to go through. I mean, just even hang on just a second. Just even to there's so many people around the world that they don't even have the ability to have running water in their house. And yet here in America, we're like, oh, I don't have a phone. What am I going to do? Or, you know, I wanted to watch that TV show tonight. I don't want to go help somebody do something over there. And yes, I know I can record it and watch it later. Still, 20 years ago, they could have made that excuse. It doesn't really work anymore nowadays. Yes?
My observation, especially with Christians, those who really need help, you'll never know it. You have to seek out those opportunities, especially with single women and children.
Yeah, we need to seek it out. That's an excellent point. And most people don't like to just share their problems all over the place. And I mean, for the most part, there is some merit to that. Now, you don't want to burden everybody else down, but there are quite a few things that you need help with. And it can be difficult sometimes even to admit to yourself that you need help with this thing. So that's why it is important that when we need to keep our eyes open, and that's why we need to be together. We need to be spending time together. That way we can see these, when these needs pop up, we don't wait for them to ask us for help. Go take care of it. Yes.
I've been reading about neuroscience and how it relates in like a pitching clients and things like that. And one of the pieces of advice that they always give you when you pitch is eliminate all signs of neediness. Because it actually stimulates a fight or flight response in the brain of the person you're talking to. It's almost like, okay, you're needy, I'm not going to help you. It's an immediate turn off and you want to run the other way. And it's interesting to me that God tells us, no, you help the needy.
Yeah. Yeah, our first instinct needs to be to try and help, not to try and run. And that can be difficult sometimes, but oh well. We are here. We took on this life. We became Christians. We don't do things because it's easy. We do things because it's right. Yes.
Church designed by the Lord, by God, intended for us to be in a community. That's His design. That's not just something we just volunteer in the church. This is what He put together for the benefit of all of us to be able to get through this life with our physical needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then it's up to us as individuals to fulfill our role inside that structure.
Yeah, and like we say, it's to fulfill our role, because we do have roles. We absolutely have things that we need to do inside the...
Like we should. But that, we're there for that purpose. We're intended to be there for one another.
Yeah.
And that's my design.
Yeah.
The Lord's design.
Excellent, yes.
Yeah, and I was going to say, to dovetail off of Dave's comment, is out of all the things that we should not do in spending our money as a church, as a collective, as an eldership, one of the things that's for sure an example that we are to do is benevolence. I mean, we are to help those that are in need amongst our flock. But there's lots of things we don't do with our money, and that's good because we don't have authorization to do that. But that's one we do, and that should give us the onus to constantly on guard with the flock and with each other to help take care of those needs, you know. But
yeah. Yeah, excellent point. Having that small safety net just to help in that moment of need is very beneficial. Yes?
I think it's also important to note that when we're denying ourselves and serving others, it kind of needs to be how they need to be served. So it may not be a one-time, yeah, you can stay at my house tonight. They may need a more permanent solution for that, not just small time during their life, but it may be a full season of life that they need that help. And we've got to be committed to give it when they need it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good point. This is not a, all right, you know, I helped you out this one night, don't let the door hit you on the way out. this may take some patience here, and it could take a while. But we do what needs to be done. Absolutely. I want to get to look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. This might turn this on its head just a little bit, and I want to see where this goes. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. Is this a little contrary to what we've just been talking about? No.
I think you have to define the word need.
Yeah.
Need can cover, is it a need or is it a want? Is it something that that a person truly needs that they absolutely cannot do or get for themselves? I think in our benevolent work,
yeah, define our needs and wants. That is a very good way to look at it. And quite honestly, if we sat down and listed all our needs versus all our wants, we might be a little surprised at what we end up putting on the list. And we have to admit that we are spoiled beyond what we really would like to admit sometimes. Any other thought for this? Yes. Yeah, balance is a good term to consider. I mean, it's when we're trying to help somebody, it doesn't really help the overall cause if we give away too much, and then now we are the ones that are in serious need of help. But having a balance there is definitely an important concept.
If you're
being a lazy bum, and you're riding off of the backs of other hardworking brothers and sisters, that's not yes. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And again, yeah, we need to know each other. We need to be, as you said, a family. Your family don't just ignore each other. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Unity. One part, one soul. Yes.
I think to genuinely help without looking for recognition, it comes from the heart that way. There are lots of people that want to help, but then they want to tell everybody that they helped. And so, to me, if it really is going to come from the soul and the heart, you're doing it for the cause, no one may ever know about it, and that should be fine with you. And so, I really believe the strength is in numbers. So when you look at a congregation like this, all of us together can beat anything. But when it starts getting splintered, where you only have one or two, and then people, when we start using the word I and me a lot, we get into trouble. And I think that kind of stuff is the demise of a congregation when you start to fracture it, because everyone is not working together for the cause.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It sounds like you had X5 on your mind. In essence of fire, that's exactly what they did. They had that selfish me on their mind, and they just wanted the recognition, and that didn't turn out so well for them, obviously. I want to get to 2 John real quick. There's another part to this that kind of turns this on its head just a little bit. Verse 10. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house. Do not give him a greeting. That doesn't sound very hospitable. Well, specifically in this context, he's talking about those who do not acknowledge that Jesus came in the flesh.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, kind of an address to probably Gnosticism in that case. But, again, usually something is coming and clearly has false intentions or ill will, or you're not doing anything by offering them a quote-unquote hospitality. All you're doing is possibly making yourself a victim, possibly losing your own soul,
Verse 11, for the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. Yeah. All right, I need to get to Matthew 25. I want to end here at Matthew 25 tonight, because this is a very... a very powerful statement from Jesus. Verse 31 of Matthew 25. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, from the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you did not invite me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. Then they themselves will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger, naked or sick or in prison and didn't take care of you? Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. These will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. This is not optional. I mean, at least for anyone who actually wants to go to heaven, which should be all of us. The whole reason why we're here tonight, isn't it? Yes.
The passages really would scare the daylights out of me. Because it used to be my practice, I think I was too cynical when it came time to offering hospitality or meeting a need of somebody that maybe I didn't know. I would assume circumstances, maybe not have the evidence to do that. And I wonder sometimes if we don't get in that frame of mind, we automatically assume because somebody's in a similar circumstance that I've dealt with before, they're going to use this for ulterior motives or means or whatever. For the last several years, I've tried to flip that and be more liberal in my giving. You know, using discernment, as Alan mentioned, but not being so quick to assume something negative. And instead do as I have been commanded to do, as you just mentioned here. But this is not a suggestion. This is not a give some consideration to it. No, this is, you do it. And to listen to the language that he uses here, you take it to heart, get down right scary.
Yeah, it, benefit of the doubt goes a long way. I mean, it is easier to make excuses and to use a cynical reason as to your excuse, but that doesn't really help the person in need. Yes.
It's not so much about what we do, but who we are. That's who we are. That's who we have to be. Those things that they do will come, like you said earlier, second nature.
Yeah. Yeah, and those things will become second nature if we are loving. If we are loving and if we are denying ourselves. Yes. All right, thank you. Next week we're going to look at honor.